Hi, everyone. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media, and welcome to our ongoing series of Personal Democracy Plus teleconference calls, which we do every week with movers, shakers, thinkers, and doers in the field where politics and technology collide. This week, we are excited to be joined by a longtime friend of PDF, former speaker at our conference, Siva Vyadinathan, who teaches at the University of Virginia and is the author of several really important books, one, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, The Anarchist in the Library, How the Clash Between Freedom and Control is Hacking the Real World and Crashing the System, and most recently, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry, which came out last year from the University of California Press. We're going to be talking about all of those topics and also taking your questions. I should say that the call is being recorded and will be turned into a podcast. And you can tweet during the call if you have a question or comment using the hashtag PDPlus. PDPLUS, or you could just email me directly, and I'll take your question, msifri@gmail.com, and I'll plug it into the conversation. And also about halfway through, we'll open up the lines and let folks who are listening chime in directly if you feel like it. But I will be keeping an eye on my email and on that hashtag. So, Siva, I guess, you know, a lot has happened since the book came out a year ago, and you know, I think, you know, we actually had this call on the calendar once or twice earlier, you know, and then we had to reschedule for different reasons. But in some ways, I think it's kind of fun to come back to you, you know, a full year after the book came out and sort of ask you, you know, not just to, you know, recapitulate the themes. I mean, you know, obviously the concerns you were raising are still quite relevant, but also, you know, to look at some of the particulars, be it, you know, Google's role in the sort of information universe, as well as some of the other big players. And, you know, there have been some important events in the last year and you know, kind of would love to get your take. So, you know, why don't we start with, you know, what have you, you know, is there anything you would change, you know, now that it's been a year since you wrote The Googleization of Everything? Is there, you know, do you still feel like the book holds up well, or are there arguments that you would, you know, you'd modify or expand on?
Yeah. So one of the things that I could not have foreseen is the sort of personality change that Google has gone through since Eric Schmidt stepped down as CEO and Larry Page has taken over as CEO. It's not a radical personality shift, but you know, first thing Larry Page did was shut down a few of the sort of extraneous beta services that weren't particularly popular but were important to very small, discrete groups of people. You know, the Newspaper History Project, for instance, just to name one. You know, but, you know, clearly at that point Larry Page was saying, let's get back to our core mission little bit. Now, the second thing I think that's more interesting is that you know, Larry Page decided to take on the sociality of the web front and center instead of sort of nibbling around the edges of it. And I think Google Plus is but one element of that. You know, one of the maddening things, as you know yourself, about writing about anything tech-based, internet-based, is the frenetic pace and the question of, you know, how could I possibly be done when tomorrow something huge might break? And the other problem you have writing about these issues is, let's say something breaks and you think it's huge, and then lo and behold, it's not so huge anymore.
Yeah.
Google Wave being a really good example of that, right? So, you know, there are a couple of things I think I would have made maybe stronger or more sort of better articulated. One is the overall privacy issue, privacy question, largely because I think we can learn a lot about what Facebook's going through and what's going on the web in general from looking at Google's experience. That's point number one. And I think, you know, while I tackled it and I did make it central, I think I could have done more. But the second thing is I think most of it holds up because Google is no less important in our lives, and Google is no less important globally. In many ways, it may actually be more important today than it was a year ago, even though Facebook has taken so much of the energy and attention. But one of the things I tried my best to do, and I think I failed, is to explain the brilliance of the people who work there. You know, like what it means to view the world algorithmically, what it means to approach really big, interesting intellectual questions from the point of view of a Google engineer. And the only way I knew that I had failed was by reading Steve Levy's book in the Plex and realizing, oh my God, he nailed it. And I really didn't. And so fortunately, I think for everybody, myself included, Steve Levy's book came out just months after mine and I think filled in all of the gaps. So,
well, and we did a call with Steve Levy last summer, but I would say, you know, Steve Levy writes much more from the perspective of a fan. And thus had access that you couldn't have gotten.
And I wasn't interested so much in access. And you know, it's hard to convince people this all the time, but, you know, I wasn't trying to write a biography of the company or even an analysis of the company. Mm-hmm. The company doesn't interest me nearly as much as our embrace and trust.
Right.
That's the story that I – you know, back in 2004 when I first started paying attention to Google, I realized, oh, my goodness, like this company is not only powerful, destined to be rich, very interesting, full of brilliant people, but it engenders so much trust. I mean, people I respect deeply were just unwilling to raise what I thought were really important questions about the company's behavior, especially in the areas of privacy. And so, you know, for that reason, I was fascinated by its role in our culture and in our lives and in our minds more than its business activities or its computer science contributions, all of which I think are fascinating in and of themselves. And I'm glad that Steve did so much of what I couldn't do. So, you know, this book is supposed to be about us, and I hope that even if Google goes away, the themes and issues remain lively. The question of the role of trust that we put into corporations, the notion of corporate social responsibility. I mean, Google is but one of dozens of companies that make corporate social responsibility key to their identities in the world, and thus an important part of their public image, their marketing plans, their ability to work their way into our lives. And to me, that is such a burning issue. I have some deep concerns about whether corporate social responsibility in the long run actually depoliticizes us. And that's actually going to be the subject of my next book.
No, that's an interesting thought, too. But there are a lot of questions that arise for me. I mean, the first one, which is let's why don't we start the conversation with a focus on Google and then sort of pull back to more broadly, you know, the implications for the public sphere in an age when, you know, companies like Facebook, who don't play anywhere near as nicely with the web as Google tries to, are, you know, wrapping their arms around more and more of people's attention. And then, you know, obviously I want to get to the SOPA-PIPA protests with you and get your take on all of that. But just first with Google, and I think that's really shrewd of you to point to the shift under Larry Page and the, you know, supposedly a memo went around from Page, you know, making clear to Google employees that his number one priority is to, you know, get the company in a position where they are starting to win on the social graph side of the web and not just in search. And that is raising a question that people like Danny Sullivan at Search Engine Watch, was it Search Engine Watch, I think is the name of his, you know, that Google is no longer abiding by its own, you know, stated position of search neutrality. We just give you the best results, whatever they are. and instead is starting to favor, in particular, results that, you know, have the effect of pulling people into the Google Plus universe.
And
are you seeing that? Do you agree with that?
I think it's older. Yeah, I think it's older than the move to social and the move to include social results in search. I think Google has tried to play it both ways. Has tried, especially in some high profile cases, to convince people that it's not us, it's the algorithms, or it's not us, it's the web. So consider the anti-Semitic links that come up when you search for the word Jew. This has been a burning issue for Google since 2003. The Anti-Defamation League approached Google about it. And Sergey Brin, who is as sensitive as anybody in the world to this question, was able to convince the Anti-Defamation League that, you know, Google merely measures the craziness of the web, and if the web remains overly represented by people like that, that's just an unfortunate and hopefully temporary anomaly. And that you know, you can't blame Google because no one at Google is making that editorial choice, and that satisfied the Anti-Defamation League at the time. What we've seen, of course, has been since then have been a number of clear statements by Google that in fact Google does impose editorial decisions upon search results, never directly, except in one case that I'll bring up in a moment, but always at a distance, at the distance of the algorithm. But there's still a question of value choices. So when Google decided about a year ago that it would alter Google News results, a lot of people were paying attention to the fact that content farms, the you know, sort of the high-class content farms like Huffington Post, but all the way down to the low-class content farms that were just link bait, you know, they were – dominating Google News by playing search engine optimization games really, really well. And there were a lot of legitimate news services that were losing out in the attention game from Google News. And Google put up a blog post describing how both in regular web search and in news, they were going to start favoring what they called high-quality news sites without ever defining what high-quality means. Even if they had, we all kind of know what it means. It means that, you know, mainstream American newspapers and television networks are going to get favored treatment by Google. And if – and that's okay, as you know, in some circles, right? If you want to say, well, you know, Google thinks this is good for the web and I do too, and I happen to, that's fine. But to pretend that you can have it both ways, that Google is somehow neutral in search and it's making editorial decisions like that, that doesn't cohere, right?
Yeah.
So there was one other troubling case when November of 2010, a racist caricature of Michelle Obama rose to be the top Google image search of Michelle Obama, and it was up there for a couple of weeks, and this was a Google bombing thing. This was a Santorum-esque event. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much of an organized effort to move something up in a context like that. And Google removed the image from its database, and then upon being reminded that it had not done the same for Jewwatch News, for instance, the major anti-Semitic site that shows up in many searches, Google replaced the image back into the image search algorithm. But significantly, and no one's really sure why, it's now very low in Google searches. I did it for a class the other day. I found the image on page 6 of the results of images for Michelle Obama. So it's still there. It's just been downgraded, which is Google's usual pattern. So you really have to ask, like, okay, is Google taking on the custodial responsibilities of the web in an overt and clear fashion, or is it still retaining that deniability when it needs to, when it's convenient?
Yeah. But the place where they'll run into serious trouble is if they start favoring their own products.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and that's the accusation that Danny Sullivan was raising, that, you know, now they're not, you know, they link to results that favor YouTube videos over any videos, and they link to results that favor Google Plus pages over, you know, any social page.
Sure.
And, you know, will the FTC, you know, is there sort of a Microsoft-like problem here?
It's not quite a Microsoft problem because Google's not as coercive as Microsoft, but
Yeah.
But in Europe, it's already the subject of a major investigation, this notion that,
mm-hmm.
that Google favors its own products. And that's, that Google's lawyers are quite aware of that. I suspect, I haven't written anything about this and I haven't read anyone else writing about it, but I suspect that this move to sort of federate information gathered by Google's various products into one single profile for the sake of both advertising placement and search results is in many ways an antitrust move, because there's a concept within antitrust that prohibits companies that make a lot of money in or are dominant in the marketplace in practice A or market A from underselling or zeroing out the price in market B merely to keep people at bay. So if market A, which is web-based advertising, is so clearly dominated by Google, to use the surplus from that to cross, the term is cross-subsidization, to
right.
cross-subsidize another area, whether that's email or video or social, is potentially illegal. And by combining these fields of information, they have a better argument to make that Google is not separate services, but is one cohesive way of experiencing internet communication.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's just a hunch, though. Who knows?
Okay, that's interesting. But then how do you – so let's talk about Facebook for a bit, because Facebook seems they're clearly trying to build a walled garden. And in some ways they're succeeding, some very scary ways. I was recently learning a bit about Facebook Zero, which is not something you hear much about in the U.S., but which is a special mobile version of Facebook that they are rolling out all over the world, making deals with mobile carriers to basically put Facebook on people's phones for free, right? There's no data charge associated with going to Facebook, but what people then get is the truly walled version of Facebook. They don't, get out to the larger internet from there. And it's, Facebook Zero, the zero is we're not charging you, right? But of course, you're not really the customer, are you? You're the product. And, if that is indeed how they're going to vacuum up the next billion people who come online, who will never even know what the internet was because they can't afford to get to it, and instead they're being given this sort of cheapened version,
yes.
What does that do to Facebook's overall market power? That's a very serious question, and it's not even on the table here at all, let alone the other moves that they're making. But, how do you think about Facebook and shouldn't your book – maybe the book should be called The Facebookization of Everything. And, how would you talk about that?
I used to like to say that if I had written a book raising concerns about the effect of Facebook on our lives, it would have been way too easy. The reason that Google is a fascinating institution
mm-hmm.
is that it does so much great stuff for us and is impossible to live without and makes our lives better. And so to raise – concerns and issues about our dependence is not an easy case to make, and that, I thought that challenge made it like just more meaty and more honest, right? But writing a book about Facebook wouldn't take as many pages for one thing. But now
might still be a useful thing to do.
But I used to think that. Now I spent some time at the Facebook offices in New York in January, and just talking to some people in their advertising and marketing side, just to get a sense of how they see their role in the company, right? Because these are people who are doing kind of old media work. They're hanging out, flying to Cincinnati to meet with Procter & Gamble and trying to sell them ad space. And at the same time, they're trying to leverage their tremendous wealth of information for the sake of the sort of newer ad placement. And we all know that Facebook's ad placement is nowhere near as an ad program is nowhere near as effective or profitable as Google's.
Mm-hmm.
Despite Google's panic about it all, Google has a way of making money, and Facebook really hasn't figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was fascinating to me is it was clear that they saw Facebook as an operating system for your life.
Mm-hmm.
Not as a web thing, not as an internet thing, but as something so deeply embedded in your daily experience that it becomes an operating system for navigating the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how Google sees itself, right? Because Google's mission statement is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. There's not a word in there about the internet, about the web, about the computer, about the mobile phone. It is a technologically agnostic statement about information and the world. And Facebook sees it as organizing your life.
Well, also
and
not just organizing.
Universally accessible, right?
Yeah, it's there's a piece there. You know, I mean, I was reading Ethan Zuckerberg's letter to potential investors, and you know, it is riddled with language about making the world a better place by making it more open and transparent. Which, by the way, you know. In principle, I agree that more openness and transparency can make the world a better place. But it's, you know, my theory of this is you shouldn't force that on individuals. Maybe you should force it on powerful institutions that, you know, abuse individuals.
If we're going to do that, let's do it together in collaboration without using this corporate filter. That serves its own ends, right? So the fascinating thing about the idea of becoming the operating system for our lives is, again, it's technologically agnostic. It doesn't have to be something that runs over TCP/IP. It doesn't have to be something that sits on a computer run by Microsoft Windows, right? And in that way, now, of course, that's the only way they have to sell ads right now. They haven't sold ads over their phone app, and they haven't figured out how to do it in a way that wouldn't really anger everybody. No one has. But the notion of their, if you boil that down into sort of business terms, their mobile strategy, and I think you've illustrated it quite well, is so it's the default operating system when you open up your phone, or if we call them phones, right? Our handheld devices, right?
Right.
And that's the place you would start looking for news in your area, and that's the place you would start figuring out if the weather's changing and those sorts of things, you know. And for as you pointed out, if the application is light enough and dependable enough that it can work in Niger and Indonesia as well as it does in Los Angeles, that is, you know, a great way to achieve or get close to achieving that notion of being the globe's personal operating system, right? So it's not about information. It's about personality in that sense. And so you can start to see, especially in that letter, in Zuckerberg's letter to investors, a convergence of amazing, almost megalomaniacal vision of these companies, Google and Facebook, right? And so Facebook resembles Google more than ever before since that letter, since the IPO.
Yeah. You really think so? I mean, I have to say, I don't quite see the resemblance at all. I mean, I think that, you know, Google's still a very big piece of Google's DNA is that it needs the open web to succeed. It needs information to be universally accessible in order to organize it for everyone, right? And to the degree that, you know, you can't search Facebook unless, you know, Facebook decides to create a search tool someday, Facebook is walling off, I always say to my students, you know, the Facebook's just a very, very, very big, sophisticated and walled blogging platform.
Right.
And, you know,
well,
unfortunately,
it's always like, if you want to do interesting computer science, don't go working for Facebook, right?
Well, no, they are probably doing very interesting, you know, but it is cutting against the entire notion of the open network that made the internet, you know, makes the internet succeed. And, you know, that's a very interesting project.
Both companies, operate very differently, and they have different investments in the open web. Google is committed to making sure that the web remains vital, open, trustworthy, pleasant, useful in our lives, and Facebook could care less about.
Right.
Couldn't care less about the open web, right? Facebook
right.
would like us all to write our content within Facebook if it could do it, right? Post our videos within Facebook so they don't have to link to YouTube. That would be great for Facebook. In
mm-hmm.
the meantime, they're happy to, you know, let us in without letting us out, right? So,
right.
So that's all. You're absolutely right about the differences. The differences are crucial. What I meant by the convergence is a convergence of that sort of ostentatious mission, right? That notion mm-hmm. that a company will be so crucial to the way that we do our conduct our lives,
mm.
and that a company is trustworthy enough to claim that and not have people scream or laugh is interesting too, right? So
right.
that's why I say, like, today I'm starting to think you're right that Facebook deserves a complex treatment. In a way that goes beyond, for instance, the Facebook effect, which is an excellent story of Facebook's
mm-hmm.
rise. But I just
right.
think now we are in Facebook 2.0, and we are in a moment where Facebook's vision for itself goes way beyond what Zuckerberg ever articulated before.
What do you think of, you know, when you see, you know, President Obama or, you know, some Republican House leaders, you know, going to Facebook and doing these, you know, town hall things, or the degree to which Facebook is ingratiating itself with governments around the world? I mean, how do you think about that subject? I have my thoughts, but I'm curious what, you know.
Well, I mean, I can't blame them for wanting to use a platform that gets a lot of attention. That's, you know, I mean, I'm not sure it's any more morally repugnant than going to Fox or going to CNN, another commercial outlet, to achieve an audience. I think it's kind of I mean, sometimes the tone of it is pandering, right? That this is
right.
where the young people are. Like, that kind of stuff really bugs me because it's
mm-hmm.
where everybody is. It's not young people. I don't know. It's – I mean, in some ways, if you don't engage with YouTube and Facebook, you're a sucker, right? you're not allowing for whatever limited level of interactivity –
Let me rephrase the question.
Yeah.
Let me rephrase the question. Because
sure.
obviously, you know, if you're a politician, you need to go where the crowds are. But if you go on CNN, you know, ostensibly you're being questioned by an independent journalist, not CEO of CNN.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the business and the editorial sides are somewhat separate. And that part of the credibility of big, you know, media has been that, you know, they do keep those things somewhat separate or completely separate. You know, but here we've got Obama or Boehner, you know, being questioned by Mark Zuckerberg. This is not a real town hall meeting. This isn't a news conference. That's what I'm asking about.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I have the same sort of reservations about that as well. If it were a true interactivity, right? If it were, if it were something like, you know, a Twitter conversation. I mean, we've seen celebrities do these sort of Twitter marathon conversations with people. I saw Louis C.K. do a couple of them, you know, and
mm-hmm.
you know, that seems to me like a real interaction, limited, of course, by the medium, but something that can perhaps teach the politician about a concern or an issue in an unfiltered way, in a way that might surprise him or her. That, to me, has great potential, whereas you're right, like, to take that star turn with Zuckerberg, that bugs
mm-hmm.
me tremendously. You know,
well,
like,
given the work you've done on, you know, where is the public, you know, interest here, or
right.
what's happening to public space and public discourse? And so, you know, to me, I mean, every time I see, you know, kind of the White House fires up a live event on the White House homepage, and alongside it, they're running the same event on Facebook and showing the Facebook chat. And it's sort of like, what? When did that become the norm?
Right.
Should it be the norm? You know, and if it is, by the way, if Facebook is this public utility or de facto, right, the place where you know, everybody is gathering, should we, you know, start talking about regulating it as some kind of public utility with public responsibilities instead of, you know, a company that now is about to be, you know, privately, I mean, you know, it's going to be on the stock market and, you know, all the pressures that come with that.
Well, so, I mean, for one, we do actually heavily regulate Facebook more today, or more once it actually is traded publicly than before. You know, once it's a publicly traded company, it does have fiduciary responsibilities and responsibilities to disclose, and that's actually, I think, going to make things a lot better for all of us. We'll have a much more realistic sense of what it's worth as a business, and in some ways, what it's worth in our lives. But that said, you know, this is the real question: what spaces should we be building to enhance democracy? Like, that's the question we should be starting with, and not how can we leverage this awesomely popular platform for X, Y, or Z. That's missing it backwards, right?
Right.
You know, you and I would both like to see people, and there are people doing this, right? We know them. A lot of them are clustered at Berkman Center who are trying to build and or enhance experiments around the world to connect citizens to governments, to make government information more visible and useful. To map problems in ways that governments forget to, right, to be able to correct for public failures, those sorts of things, in a non-commercial way. And those sorts of experiments, that's where the action is. That's where the creativity is. That's where the really awesome potential of digital networks lie. And yes, I do wish that the people in the White House, and, you know, we know people who've worked in the White House recently who understand exactly what we're talking about here. I wish that they would do a better job of putting the president in a position to say, let's have a different kind of forum. Let's host a forum ourselves right here on whitehouse.gov that allows for fuller interactivity, you know, and doesn't necessarily end up being a stunt.
Right. But again, with the exception of a handful of people, our media don't even know to ask these questions.
Right. Well, we're working on it, right?
We're working on it. I'm going to pause here just since we're at the halfway point and see if anybody who's listening wants to unmute their phone and jump in with a question. The way to do that is just hit star 6, and I will see you here on my dashboard. We'll just pause to allow that to take place if anyone wants to. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Just to continue, something else just happened, though, Siva, which I think, you know, whoops, actually, I'm going to pause it. I see somebody does have a question. We'll come to, go ahead, just introduce yourself and ask your question, please.
Siva, my name is Stephen Hallixer. I've commented before on one of these previous programs. Before I ask my question, I'd like to compliment this series. It's very, very interesting. I regret haven't been able to go to more of them, but I'm going to try to attend as many as I can. It's very interesting, and I encourage your efforts.
Thank you.
I have a blog that's called Digital Governing, and on that blog I've been posting recently about big data. And you were commenting on the issue of regulating Facebook like a public utility. And I wonder if you would sort of think about or comment about the issue of this huge amount of data that's being accumulated by private companies from, you know, mobile phones, from all kinds of sensors, automobiles. It's a deluge of data. And it's all proprietary, and yet data is becoming the thing that really drives our economies and societies. Shouldn't there be regulation of these huge, you know, data agglomeration enterprises as public utilities?
That's a great question.
I don't think we need to go to the public utility model quite so quickly, but I do think that we're dealing with a phenomenon that you've identified exactly correctly, that data is a raw material these days, a raw material that companies and governments and increasingly individuals rely on in sets never before imagined. And that's because everything's cheaper to move and accumulate and mine and read, et cetera, right? But this is also new to us, that we haven't figured out the etiquette, we haven't figured out the ethics, and we haven't figured out the laws that would be appropriate to making sure that there's not abuse, to making sure that there's not a fundamental misreading of big data. And I think that what we actually need are a series of really sort of high-level examinations and open examinations. The national academies would be a great place to start this conversation, but by all means not end them, to say, okay, when you're dealing with big data in the sciences, what are the best practices and what are the problems? What do we miss with the current techniques? When you're talking about big data in the commercial world, you know, data that Walmart collects, data that Food Lion collects, data that Safeway collects, data that Barnes & Noble collects, let's think about, again, best practices in terms of security, in terms of use and abuse, in terms of profiling, in terms of the sale, the market for those data sets. Often those data sets get sold to law enforcement, creating this amazingly powerful and yet probably inaccurate surveillance state that we don't even get to watch, right? Those sorts of things are happening. I think we need to make them clear, that we need to make the ramifications clear, and we have to come up with a really strong set of recommendations that pay attention to simultaneously, A, not quashing creativity within the corporate world. That would be a bad externality. But we also want to make sure that individuals and groups are protected, right? Because we're, you know, for the last 10 years, we've been sort of reinvigorating the surveillance techniques that we saw the Nixon administration get in so much trouble for. It's just for some reason people aren't getting angry about it this time. You know, it's like the Nixon administration and the Johnson administration before it did so much to abuse citizens' rights by creating, you know, surveillance and spying programs domestically. And Americans of all kinds were so upset in the early 70s when this got revealed that Congress easily passed a series of fairly strong laws that, you know, President Ford and Carter quickly signed, even though President Ford's chief of staff, a gentleman named Richard Cheney, immediately started undermining them. You know, and that was a high point in so many ways. That was a moment at which we said, okay, the government has to play fair. We need to know as much about the government as the government knows about us.
Yep.
You know, and we took that. We got so comfortable in the wake of that that we've just let the last 10 years roll by without any real anger, any real examination, and any response.
Well,
and now we just accept it.
Or you know, it sort of crept in ways that were invisible, and because of that, you know, people don't feel victimized in this.
It's always invisible at first, right? So,
yeah.
You know, the efforts to spy on anti-war protesters in the late 60s was invisible for a while, even though it was always the crew cut guy at the at the SDS meeting, right? So,
right.
But to most Americans, it was. But, you know, so look, in 2005, when the New York Times finally revealed, after sitting on the story for a year, that the Bush administration had been breaking the law and listening in on phone calls of American citizens, the outrage was against the New York Times, either for reporting it or, as I've just pointed out, reporting it a year too late to have kicked Bush out of office. And at no point was there a criminal investigation of the Bush administration. And at no point was there citizen uproar over this.
Well, but let's talk about this, because, I mean, I think that, you know, to some degree, it may be that you're right, and it's, you know, kind of too late. People have just gotten so used to this, or they support it because they think it's making them safer or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is, you know, even right now, I mean, literally as we speak, there's this big backlash, you know, in the tech press that's reached the point that Congress is, you know, pushing on Apple, and Apple is responding on this issue of how much data, you know, these apps are collecting. And you know, feeding back to the company servers without people's knowledge. You know, this question of how much do they know about me, I think, is still up for grabs. That's one. And then, you know, I think something also changed, and I really do want to get your point of view on what just happened with the fight over the Stop Online Privacy Act and the Protect IP Act and the, you know, sort of sudden shockwave of you know, public opposition that crested on January 18th.
Right.
And, you know, we saw a bill that was, you know, seemingly passing through the bowels of Congress like a dose of salt, as you know, you might put it, was suddenly, you know, reversed, and you know, members from both parties who thought this one was greased, and good to go, suddenly saying, "Wait a second, we need to take another look." So, is it possible that, you know, you know, obviously companies like Google were important to helping marshal that opposition, though in many ways they came late to the parade.
Definitely.
And, you know, I think there was a lot of, you know, genuine grassroots or netroots type organizing happening across the political spectrum from the non-commercial part of the web, the, you know, if you will, the public part of the web. So does this give you hope, or and do you think there's
so
something?
So much hope. You know, I never thought of myself as jaded or cynical until I stumbled upon my own jadedness. And that was the day before Wikipedia went dark. I tweeted that this protest wasn't going to make the slightest bit of difference because no one in Congress cares what Wikipedia does, and no one in Congress cares what some element of the public, which tends to be curious about these sorts of issues, would think, right? I was in such despair about how corrupt Congress is that I just thought that this was going to be another empty internet protest. And I'm so happy that I was wrong. Within a day, I tweeted that I was wrong. And I'm so happy that I was wrong, right? You know, like,
shall we just pause here for a second, folks, and note that how refreshing it is to hear someone to say, "Yeah, I got it wrong," and good. I mean, you know, okay, Siva, go back to
And of course, it's so much better to be a wrong about something where the result is something you wanted. You know, that helps too, right?
Yeah, but there are a lot of intellectuals kind of who stuff, never admit fail. You know, people who never, you know, you know too many of those people.
So, you know, here was the thing. I mean, I, you know, as I said earlier, like, I'm a cynic about corporate social responsibility. And what we see here in the case of Google especially, but is that, you know, obviously the public interest coincides with Google's interest, as it does fairly frequently. But I just think it's important that we not conflate the two and not assume that Google speaks for the public interest. It just happens to be that fighting these two bills was in our interest as well as Google's, and that's great. And I'm glad. I'm always glad to have allies, right? You know. So, I thought that Congress was insulated from geek protests. I thought that this issue, having lived in these copyright issues and these tech issues for 12 years now, 13 years now, since the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, if you can call them debates of 1998, I was fairly convinced that while awareness about copyright, excessive copyright protection was high, while interest was high, I just didn't think we had reached critical mass yet. I thought it was too early in the movement. You know, back in 1998, when the only people raising these issues were a handful of law professors and librarians, it was tough going, right? And the Clinton administration just did not allow for debate or dissent on copyright issues. This was one of these consensus issues that all Americans are for Hollywood triumphing in the world, et cetera, right?
Right.
And those of us who said, but wait a minute, the results of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act are likely to be worse than the problems it's trying to solve. And it, besides, it's not going to solve the problems. Like, we just got no play at all. You know, the New York Times didn't care about our argument. And I remember those arguments, and then I was happy to see that groups like Public Knowledge, groups like EFF were able to play defense through most of the last decade and knock down some really onerous proposals. But these two bills were the worst of all of them and had the best chance of going through. And, you know, I just was in despair about it. But it worked, and it was stunning to me. And you know, it was partially that Google and Wikipedia raised awareness. I remember the day of the Wikipedia blackout. Three of my friends who were not real tech people, not copyright people, came up to me to ask me about these bills. This was the first they had heard about them.
Wow.
And it was only because they had a habit of going to Wikipedia, and they happened to have said, hey, wait a minute, here's something I need to ask you about, right? And I thought, okay, if these three people are coming up to me randomly saying, tell me about this SOPA thing, then something is happening here.
Something
right?
deep. Yeah.
And man, so that's when I realized I was wrong. It's like, okay, this Wikipedia is embedded in our lives to such a degree that that it has the ability to get people to at least be curious.
Right.
And that's such a victory.
Right.
So, and then
right. Well, they claim they had something like 167 million page views of their SOPA PIPA page.
Yeah.
And that they generated, you know, several million phone calls. I mean, the, you know, 8 million lookups of member contact information on their site. Don't know how many people actually called. But I, you know, there's one other piece. I mean, I think what Wikipedia did was significant. But what was most interesting to me in this was how Tumblr kind of crossed a line that I don't think I've ever seen a for-profit tech company do up to this point. And they weren't the only ones, but they happened to be first, which was back in November when they were getting concerned about, you know, the way these bills were starting to sail through Congress. They decided for one day to interrupt their users. And, you know, they didn't just send an email to all their users. They made it so that if you tried to go to your dashboard in Tumblr, you saw all this blacked out text. And basically a big, you know, warning that this is the possible effect of this law passing. And they generated about 90,000 phone calls in one day. But they took a huge risk, right? I mean, you know, Google, all Google did was block out, you know, their logo. You could still use Google right? Whereas Tumblr was like saying, no, this is so important and critical to our, you know, ability to be, you know, what we are as a company and also to you, our users, to do what you're doing with us, that we'll risk driving you away, right? It's a competitive marketplace. It isn't like Tumblr has a monopoly. You know, we had this conversation here at Harvard last week at the Kennedy School on, you know, power politics in the age of Google. And you know, one of the premises of this was, did Google, you know, kind of abuse its power? After all, it is one of the top two or three most visited sites on the web. Obviously, that means a lot if they change their logo for the day. And Alexis Ohanian from Reddit was on the panel, and he said, pointed out that
a University of Virginia alum.
Oh, really? Oh, well, there you go. He pointed out that you know, there was little fear. He had little fear that Google would abuse this power and, you know, bully people and, you know, say go dark for a week or something, because if they did, we'd just go elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't buy that. I would say though that let's worry about that when that happens. Right.
Okay.
So this was not an abuse of power. Google still has the power to abuse its power.
Right.
Lots of companies do.
Right.
You know? And if that happens, let's deal with it. Right. So either then we go elsewhere or else we, you know, come up with some other way of reacting. But really.
But the point is that it's a more competitive marketplace online than, say, you know, your favorite TV station that, you know, is the only place you can get your favorite TV show.
I think that's true of Tumblr. I don't think that's true of Google. I think competition is not a real factor in search right now for a couple of reasons. One, to do search well, you need more than code, right? So you can have brilliant code. You can have brilliant coders. You know, you remember Cool? How many times you search for things on Cool?
No. Nope.
Cool was started by a bunch of ex-Googlers who thought they had a better idea, a better algorithm. Mm-hmm. And they thought they had a better message because it was going to make sure not to retain private data and was going to respect our privacy and do all the things Google wasn't doing. And it started with great fanfare. It had a big press release and hired a PR firm. And the result was, of course, it didn't have the infrastructure to support a big launch and crashed within 5 minutes of launching. And the first day was such a disaster that nobody ever went back. And we'll never know if Cool had the better search engine. But that's just one example. But here's the thing. To do search right, you need what Google has, which is billions of dollars of sunken infrastructure, steel, fiber optic cable, aluminum, air conditioners, you know, every
right. So the entry costs are really high.
That's one thing. And then you need a dozen years of data. The reason that Google reads our minds so well is it has such a great and rich record of the things we say we want. And that is something that you can't just start fresh with. Now, Microsoft has access to some of that. If Amazon wanted to get into that business strong, it probably could build a database that could do search in a creative way. But neither one of them really takes it that seriously. You know, Google's biggest competitor is Bing, and Bing is really all about shopping. It's really all about airplane tickets and hotel reservations. It's not a general purpose information tool the way that Google is, and doesn't pretend to be. So I don't think that competition is a realistic thing for either Facebook or Google, which is why they're still in a position to abuse their power. The question is, in this particular protest, was it an abuse of anything? I don't think so. I think corporations always have, always will, and probably should express their opinions about matters of public importance.
Right.
I think it's different, by the way, from electioneering, which is the question in Citizens United. But
well, if Google, you know, pointed its homepage to Barack Obama or something, that would be electioneering, wouldn't it?
It pointing maybe it would be an interesting Talmudic discussion whether pointing is electioneering. But
is it an endorsement or not? Yeah, obviously it's not an
right.
endorsement, but yes, in their case, it would be quite valuable. I mean, look, we raised the question, you know, a few years ago when Facebook gave early preferential access to the Obama campaign to develop on the Facebook platform before it was open to all developers.
Yeah.
So that, you know, and that sure looked like an in-kind contribution from Facebook.
I think so. I mean, I think pre-Citizens United, that was a big problem. These days, anything goes, which is unfortunate. So.
Yeah, well, obviously anything goes now.
No, I think that's
true.
I'm worried about the close relationship between the Obama administration and both those companies. I think it's something that we should be paying more attention to.
I agree. Well, we're almost out of time. I just want to make sure if anybody listening wants to jump in with a question to give you folks one last opportunity. Just hit *6 on your phone, and you get a chance to chime in with your thoughts, comments, or questions. Pause briefly to see if anyone else wants to do that. And then if not, Siva, I do want to ask you, given that you did write a book about copyright and copy wrongs, what is there a positive agenda here? And you know, on the copyright front, and let me just, you know, I do see a question here, so you'll take that and go ahead. It's a call from the 301 area code. Just let us know who you are and what's your question.
Hi, my name is Michael Capobianco. I'm with the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and I wanted to ask Siva about his feelings about how the Google Books lawsuit is going.
Oh,
and,
yeah, okay. So,
Google Books just filed its opposition to certification of the class, and I found it very interesting reading. I don't know if you've seen that or not yet.
I have not read
that
filing. But the Google Books project, the scanning project that began in late 2004, or at least we learned about it in late 2004, is the reason that I decided to write this book. It's what sparked my interest because – you know, that was such an amazing move for a six-year-old company to make. A six-year-old company, which at that point had been around for less time than Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston had been married. You know, and here was the, you know, the major university libraries of the world saying, yes, please, six-year-old, be the custodian of our hundreds of years and billions of dollars of resources.
Right.
It struck me as corporate welfare. It struck me as incredibly weird, right? And upside down. So there also were other, you know, sort of copyright issues that were weird about it, and privacy issues that were troubling about it. But so to me, that was the fascinating case study that launched me into my curiosity about the company. And that's when I came across that mission statement to organize the world's information to make it universally accessible. To which my first reaction was, "Who asked you guys to do that?" Right? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So that. You know, my reaction to that audacity was really important. Now, what's happened – so, you know, one of the things that held this book up for a long time, one of the reasons it didn't come out until February 2011, is that I kept waiting for Judge Chin to rule in the Google Books settlement so that I could conclude that chapter well. And I had two chapters in my hard drive. One, he approves it, and one, he rejects it, and I was going to fill in some details at the top. And he just wasn't ruling on it. He was kind of busy. So ultimately, I had to throw out those two chapters and write a fresh one, analyzing essentially both possibilities. And then that delayed everything. And the book comes out in February of 2011, and 2 weeks later, Judge Chin rules in the suit. And this rendered my book's chapters somewhat irrelevant, or at least out of date, immediately, but it did give me a great subject to talk about at that moment. And so now we're in the situation where nobody really knows what is viable or possible with the settlement, with any future settlement, what's going to happen in terms of whether, you know, authors shall be a class. And so I really am sort of at a loss about what might happen next. I think it's still a fascinating question. And I think that what we really should be focusing on, again, is the bigger question. If we want a globally accessible digital library, or digital collection, actually is the better word, is this the best way to do it? I mean, I happen to think no. Maybe other people can say yes, but let's have that argument. And if we actually think that it's a good idea to have that, how shall we do it? Shall we do it in a way that includes or runs against the short or long-term interests of authors and publishers? There may be times we want to push them out of the way for the sake of the public. There may be times we want to include them in the conversation. Mm. You know, what are the changes to copyright that we need to make this totally legal? That gets to your question, a positive agenda for copyright. There is a positive agenda for copyright that the free culture movement has been trying to get people to pay attention to. We don't have the lobbyists that the RIA has or the MPAA has, but really a couple of things. One, reintroduce what are known as formalities into copyright so that things aren't automatically protected for life of the user plus 70 years, but only if you care, only if you think that your work has a market, do you grant it the powers of copyright, which are pretty serious, right? And so if you do think it's valuable, then you get great protection for a while. And then it expires. But if you want to protect it longer, like Disney would want to with all of its films, pay a dollar and get it for another 100 years, you know? But if you don't, like Microsoft, Windows 97 is protected for 95 years. That's crazy, you know? Why not have that go in the public domain, open up the code, have people have fun with it? Yeah. So those are the sorts of things we should be talking about, just as one example.
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, thank you. That's very good food for thought. And, you know, it's certainly a topic we'll come back to. Maybe I'll have Yochai Benkler on, because I know he is pondering this very question of what a positive agenda might be for people after this sort of short-term victory on the SOPA-PIPA issue.
And the Google Books issue raises the question of how might we allow libraries to make full-text, publicly available scans of copyrighted books? Well, can we do it in a way that isn't going to throw it into court every time? I think that's a really important question.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, Siva, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating call. Great way to catch up with you and survey the horizon. I still would love to see the Facebookization. Maybe you should just do that as an ebook. I would read it. I would buy it. But thank you again for folks for listening in on this Personal Democracy Media production of PD Plus, our ongoing series of conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, and doers in the world of technology and politics.